You're listening to the Geek Saga podcast. This episode features audio that was recorded at a discussion panel at DragonCon 2024. Please consider backing us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment for early access to these podcasts and other perks.
Hey everyone, welcome to the panel on Aegon's Conquest. My name is Tara. I'm going to be the moderator. You can find me online at A Geek Saga. I have a podcast series called Hot D Takes that's on my Geek Saga podcast show, and I've done a bunch of other Aesop Game of Thrones things for well over a decade now. And I'm going to let my fellow panelists introduce themselves, and then we will get into the conversation. So...
Hi, I'm Courtney Cody. I've been coming to DragonCon for over 20 years, and this is my first time on this side of the table, so be gentle with me. I'm a director, producer, sometimes actress. I run a Game of Thrones blog called Games for the Throne and podcast. I also have a House of the Dragon edition of that.
Hi, everyone. My name is Rebecca Fan. My sister and I were talking. I think this is my 10th year at DragonCon, if I got that right, so 10-year anniversary for me. And I've been doing these panels for a few years. I love talking about anything high fantasy. During the day, I'm a middle school teacher. I teach Georgia history.
I'm Jennifer Liang. I'm the director of the high fantasy track here at DragonCon. You've probably seen me on a lot of panels because I like to be on panels. I also do other stuff. I run a fantasy literature convention called JordanCon, and I am the chair of this year's Deep South Con. If you want to know what that is, come talk to me later. And in my day job, I also work at a school, but I am the school's innovation specialist, which sounds made up. So...
But cool made up, let's be
honest. Yes.
I do like to get audience participation. We'll get the conversation started a little bit. What I do ask is that if you are able to get to a mic, that you please utilize... Is it just the one over there?
Is it not?
Okay, so there's only one. If you can't get all the way over there, I completely understand. Just make sure that if you have a question or whatever, that you talk as loudly as possible, because this room, the acoustics, as you can probably tell, aren't the best. So yeah, I will definitely open this up to audience stuff very soon. And honestly, if before I say that we're opening it up, you have something you just really need to say, just raise your hand and I will get to you as soon as possible, I promise. So this panel is, like I said, about Aegon's Conquest, which, as we all know, was Aegon not coming into Westeros, because he had been there prior to actually deciding, like, these guys are, like, kind of terrible at running their own countries. I'm going to go in and fix that. And what happened from the conquest actually led to so many different things that not just, you know, House of the Dragon, but that have carried over to the, I guess you could say, current-ish Aeswaf timeline with the main books. So what I'm going to do, Jen, why don't we start with you and kind of work our way down. What is, like, one burning question or, like, factoid or thing that you wanted to talk about on this panel?
So one of the things that I am curious about with Aegon is exactly why did he start the conquest? Because the speculation when you read the book is that he did it because he was irritated with one of the nobles who kind of scorned him and scorned his offer of a marriage to his friend. And that seems like a lot of trouble to go to just because you're irritated with one guy. I think the show has, House of the Dragon show, has tried to give it a little bit more context by saying that Aegon had access to a prophecy, Aegon's dream, that says that he has to be in control of Westeros, or his descendants have to be in control of Westeros in order to fight the Night King later on. I think that's a good start at making an explanation. I don't know if that was Martin's intention or if that's just something that's a creation of the show. But I think figuring out why Aegon went to all this trouble would be a really good thing to figure out.
For me, I don't know if we'll get all the way into the downfall of Rhaenys and Meraxes and Dorne, but I mean, I want to know what was in that letter Dorne sent Aegon to get him to stop fighting in Dorne, so.
Yeah, I'd say for me, it's kind of the same question about, you know, why he started, why he decided to rule over everything. I mean, I think I kind of understand him as a Targaryen, how that is, but I think that's an interesting
Yeah, I feel like
one.
When you have dragons, it's just like, well. And also, Jen, to your point, I know that while the prophecy thing was created for House of the Dragon, as far as I know, this was like, it was George approved. And it does make so much more sense that he started the conquest and decided he wanted to be in charge of Westeros because of that prophecy, versus, like you said, oh, I'm just angry about my BFF over here having a marriage proposal turned down and you know, and getting called a bastard on top of it, you know. I like, listen, we all know Targaryens are fiery, but that does seem, especially for Aegon, because he actually really wasn't like that, at least based on how he's described in Fire and Blood. He wasn't one of the more problematic Targs in a lot of
conquest is very methodical in how he like goes about it. Like, it's just like, okay, step one, step two, step three. And like, he's very pragmatic about how he goes about it. It doesn't read like a guy who's out for vengeance about anything.
Step four, suck really bad at conquering Dorne. And no, I'm with you, though. I want to know what was in that letter, too. There's obviously some pretty, like, hefty hints about what was probably in it in Fire and Blood, specifically, that it was something about, basically, a threat to hire faceless men to kill Aegon's favorite son, Rhaenys' son, who obviously was Aegon's favorite, because Rhaenys was Aegon's favorite. But also, I would like to know a little bit more about their thruple, I guess.
Yeah.
And how the heck that all worked, because like in Fire and Blood, it's really like kind of passed over how Visenya felt about things with Aegon and Rhaenys, but in other, I can't remember if it was World of Ice and Fire, but in other writings, George has said that there was a lot of jealousy and whatnot, and part of the reason why Visenya really went out of her way to have Maegor was because she felt like, as the first wife and the one who was supposed to be his wife over Rhaenys, if he had taken only one, that she had the right to continue her side of the line, I guess. So beyond like a burning question that you have, and I guess like I really want to touch a little bit more on Dorne, I think, because Dorne is really, to me, the most interesting part of the conquest, because everybody else just kind of, other than the Field of Fire, which was where the Westermen brought like a bazillion people, but kind of got screwed because they decided to have this battle in a very dry field with, you know, dragons breathing fire down on them. And then, of course, like the Starks just, Torrhen Stark just knelt because he was like, wow, yeah, I can't do this. I can't battle. I can't. There's nothing. My 30,000 men are going to fight literally every other person in Westeros plus dragons. But with Dorne again, they fought so hard, and they were never conquered by Aegon. So even though he was eventually crowned as king of the Seven Kingdoms, he wasn't. So what are your thoughts on how Dorne fought back and everything? Because in the text, it's like, there's a lot of, well, they were cowardly because they went and hid in caves and stuff when Aegon and his sisters came down with their dragons. So I don't know. Thoughts on how they waged their war and how you feel about it and why you think they remained unconquered.
I just love that. I think that's just another example of Dorne's always set a little bit apart culturally, the way they do their titles, the way they have their inheritance, and even the way they conduct battle, right? They're not out there fighting on a field of fire. They're going to do what they got to do to survive, which I always appreciate. I think makes Dorne and the Martells a little bit more interesting than some of the other houses.
Yeah, I don't think they were being cowardly by the strategy they picked. I think they were being practical. Like, you can't go head-to-head against dragons, and that's what happened to everybody else. That's why Torrhen Stark knelt. So they're like, okay, well, we don't want to get conquered, but also we can't go head-to-head against dragons. Mm-hmm. Let's figure out a third way, and that's what they did.
Yeah, it's definitely really smart, because it was also, I think, intentionally to annoy Aegon and his sisters, you know, because they were ready to fight and just get it over with, and you go to town, there's nobody there, you can't do anything. Mm-hmm. So I think it was really smart, and you lose less people.
Yeah, I mean, it also helps that between the mountains and the desert, obviously, that they had their land working for them and against Aegon and more specifically, the men he sent down there, because he didn't really bother too much himself with Dorne for quite a while into the fight. But another area that I wanted to touch on, just kind of going back a bit to Aegon having being married to his two sisters. Wow, how many friggin' marriage proposals did Aegon get during this whole situation? Like, he's already got two wives, and he had...
he is busy.
Seriously, Shara in the Vale, who's kind of regent for her little son, she offered to marry him. There's at least two more that...
Well, I was going to say the Storm King offered his daughter.
Yes,
right?
And there was one more beyond that, but... I don't know, like, kind of looking at it, dear kings of Westeros, why do you keep offering this guy yourselves or your daughters, etc., when you know he's already married? Like, what do you really think you're going to get out of this? And why do you think that they just kind of overlooked the fact that he already had two wives?
Well, his wives are also his sisters, and that's in Westerosi culture, that's not something you do. So they're like, if we offer him a way to have like a real marriage, like a proper marriage, maybe he'll take it. Like, you know, clearly this heathen guy is doing something that, because he just doesn't know better. So let's offer him a better alternative. Yeah, I think some of it's just like not understanding the culture of Targaryens versus the Westerosi culture.
There's a certain amount too, just grasping at straws. Like, what can we throw at him? He's got dragons, he's got an army. Let's try to make a marriage pact happen and see what sticks.
Yeah, maybe, I think it's to gain power. Because how else do you... I think that's the only thing they could think of is, okay, we can offer up a woman as property, or we could be the hand, but there were no hands yet. So, you know, I'll try to be his best friend and get in there.
I think Shara from the Vale actually sent him like a portrait of herself.
Yeah.
It's very Henry VIII and Anne of Cleves there. And on top of that, Shara was apparently like a little bit past her prime. She'd been beautiful in her youth, but she was past her prime. One of the things that I mentioned at the very beginning were the decisions that were made during the conquest that had far-reaching conclusions. Like, A, the Baratheon that... friend of his, Orys Baratheon, that he offered up to Argilac Durandon as a spouse for his daughter, ended up being, obviously, Lord of Storm's End because of this war. And then, of course, there's a whole situation with the Gardeners and the Tyrells. Mm. So what are y'all's thoughts on how the decisions that were made to place certain people or families in charge of these huge lordships, like, carried throughout the years? And I don't know, the kind of the hilarity of the fact that in the end, like, the Tyrells especially fought against the actual crowned kings. They went with Renly in Game of Thrones, Song of Ice and Fire and whatnot.
I think the regions that you see you take the Riverlands or the Reach, where you have different houses being put as lords paramount after the conquest. And those are often regions where you see some splits between the houses in the Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon in the later books, even the Iron Islands to an extent. You know, they put the Greyjoys after Harren the Black is destroyed and his line's destroyed. And those are all places that you see interregional conflict happening. You know, even in this last season of House of the Dragon, they kind of play that out with the Tullys having some issues on keeping their bannermen in line. And those are all ones that were placed in power by Aegon and weren't kings in their own right before that.
Well, you always have to have governors or people that are watching over, because it's just too, you know, it's too many people. So you kind of have to delegate some of those powers and hope that, I don't think all of them did a very great job, but some of them did.
Well, and I think it also sets up some of the seeds of Robert's Rebellion in the future, because there's two main houses that intermarried with the Targaryens more frequently than the other big families. And it was the Baratheons and it was the Martells. And the Baratheons were the ones who were like, hey, we're the next in line for the throne if the Targaryens get wiped out. And so I think that's kind of sets up some things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the funny part about that being that it was a Targaryen who put a Baratheon in power in the first place. And then in the end, it's a Baratheon who essentially takes down the Targaryens. And obviously, of course, in the Song of Ice and Fire books, we know that there are no more Baratheons other than, I guess in the books, Stannis and Shireen are still alive, but y'all, we all know they ain't gonna be. Like, even if we ignored everything that happened in the show, there's no way that Stannis and Shireen are making it to the end. The Baratheons are gonna be wiped out. And also, and with the Tyrells too, that's a really cool thing, because they were just the stewards. They were just kind of chilling, like taking care of the place while the Gardeners were off fighting the war. And then the Gardeners all die and Aegon shows up and he's like, huh, well, I guess you guys can have it then. It's very, the Tyrell, I think it was Harlan is his name. He did bend the knee when Aegon arrived. And we do know that Aegon was very open-handed with, you know, people who kneeled to him. But at the same time, it's like, really? All he has to do is like say, oh, okay, yeah, you're the king now. And it's just like, okay, well, here's Stuart. Here's an entire, like, one of the richest and most important lordships in, for sure the richest in that area of Westeros, but one of the richest and most important in the entire, like, land. And it just gets handed to him on a gold platter. Let's be real. Just to, like, skip forward a little bit to the end of the conquest. there was a lot that was left undone. You know, Aegon was crowned, and I'm not even just talking about Dorne, but there were all these little fights still going on. And even if you discount the idea of, okay, there was a prophecy and that's why Aegon was trying to take over Westeros, if you just go with book canon only, I almost think that while the catalyst could have been Oris Baratheon getting spurned by Argoac Durandon over the marriage to his daughter thing, I almost wonder if, you know, sitting on Dragonstone all these years with his sisters and all of their dragons and the Valyrians who have all these ships that can basically run the ocean, you know, in and out of Westeros, and seeing all these little tiffs that are constantly happening between the kings and their lords, and I mean, just seeing all this like just constant bickering maybe made him want to just kind of throw down a gauntlet and be like, I'm tired of this happening at my back door 24/7, so can we just not anymore? But then he goes through the whole conquest, but at the end it wasn't really all settled. There was still the Sistermen's rebellion that was happening. There was a whole bunch of chaos on the Iron Islands because Harren the Black and his whole family was gone. And in that case, thankfully, I don't know how you feel about the, at the time, maybe it sounded like a good idea, but Aegon let the Iron Islands choose their new lord. So what are your thoughts on the conquest coming to an end, but all of the kind of messiness that still seems like Aegon's king, but is he, like, he's king because they say he is, but there's still so many messes that need to be cleaned up. So anybody have thoughts on that?
So one of the things that I think is a theme, and when you look at history, is that empires don't last very long. There's very few empires that last longer than like one or two generations of ruler, because it's really easy to conquer. It is harder to build and build up infrastructure and actually like make an actual government happen. And you kind of see that with the Targaryens. Like, Aegon conquers everything and can hold on to it long enough to pass it off to his heirs. And then his heirs kind of like, you know, mess around for a while, but it's not until Jaehaerys comes along that it actually turns into a coherent kingdom that feels unified. So it takes several generations before they can actually be a, like an actual kingdom. And like Aegon is, you know, he's doing his best. Like, I don't think he's, you know, trying to like be a jerk to anyone. He's trying, like, you know, like, okay, you can keep your customs, you can pick your own rulers, you know, things that, you know, I just want to kind of be in charge. But he's not, he's not trying to make it all one coherent unit. He's just trying to be the guy in charge of everybody else.
Yeah, I don't think he had a full plan. I think he knew what he wanted to do. He knew he wanted to be king, and then he picked what he wanted to do because he wanted to go on his campaigns and go around and visit everybody and kind of party and, you know, everything. But did he just let his sisters do most of the governing? And so I think that was his plan, was just to let them deal with all of those things and him kind of be the face.
Well, the Targaryens, I mean, they're... there's constant conflicts down through the line, even, you know, smaller ones. You know, we're seeing it play out in House of the Dragon. We have the Dance of the Dragons. You have the Blackfyre Rebellions. And there's always conflict. And I think a lot of it stems from the conquest. And even within the kingdoms, they never really seem unified. There's so many that have distinct cultures, distinct religions that kind of operate as their own kingdom, just not a kingdom, more so tied to the crown, but still operating in their own way, which I think is interesting. And you know, we see it play out in the, like you said, the modern timeline of the books, but I think that's always in the background. And I've always thought it's interesting that the Targaryens do seem to just kind of do their own thing by themselves while you have these other kingdoms running and how they interact. But it's kind of like that push and pull of, you see some of those Targaryen kings later on want to marry into more of those families to make better connections, to make some changes. But at the same time, a lot of their power, especially when the dragons were around, come from kind of staying isolated into themselves and maintaining their own culture there, which I've always thought is an interesting push and pull within that family itself.
Yeah, there's like layers of cultures in Westeros. You have the first men who were there first. Well, okay, the children were there first, and then the first men were there. And then you have the wave of Vandal invasion, and then you have the Dornishmen show up, and then the Targaryens, which is a very small group of people. Like, you have ancient Valyrians show up, but they're like just one family. So you have all these different layers of culture and cultural expectations. And there's a lot of cultural conflicts between the kingdoms. Like, Catelyn Stark has a hard time understanding her husband's family because she is a Tully and she is from the Riverlands. And they have different traditions. They're much more involved with the Faith of the Seven down south, just very different. And then when she comes up north, you know, it's more of like the ancient traditions, the traditions of the mm-hmm. first men. We're still doing everything with the weirwoods, and we swear by the old gods. So you have these just layers and layers of culture and cultural expectations. And I just don't think Aegon wanted to mess with that. Like, he just didn't mm-hmm. even engage with it.
I mean, it's funny that you mention Catelyn specifically and not understand, because the thing is, the Starks were one of the few families that had been kings of their area and remained, because it was the Starks, the Lannisters, and the Aerons. Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. So, and obviously, like, I'm leaving Dorne out of here, because listen, Dorne is just independent still, and we love them for that. But yeah, the Tullys were one where they were basically, mm-hmm. they weren't nobodies. They were still like higher level lords. But when Harren the Black and his whole family was killed off, and Aegon decided to let the Iron Islands choose their own like new leader. I don't want, new lord, new high lord, whatever. Aegon was also like, there's like no point in having the Iron Islands control this like huge section of the Riverlands. Like, it's sort of close, but not close enough. They get to be their own people. And it was a Tully who had been one of the earliest, supporters of Aegon. So he was like, oh, okay, you here? You've been good to me. Here you go. Here's all of the Riverlands. Enjoy. So they came to that level of leadership a lot later than the Starks did too. Not to mention, of course, like the old gods versus the new and everything. I think I want to open it up to audience questions, because usually we have a lot. Yes.
I have a question. So we were talking about how celebrating, everyone loves an underdog. So we were celebrating how Dorne was able to resist the conquest. But as I saw it in the story, how it played out, one of the major impacts that Aegon had on Westeros was that after he became like the High King, he established the King's Peace, which it outlawed lords from fighting against each other mm-hmm. without, consent of the king. And because Dorne stayed independent, there were a lot of problems with the Marcher lords and the Dornish raids and stuff like that. So I was wondering, what about that aspect, that if Aegon had succeeded in conquering Dorne, that violence would have been avoided, etc.?
I mean, I for sure think you're right, but do I think it would have been completely avoided? No, because the fights between the Marcher lords and the lords that are on the very edge of the Reach and the Dornish had been going on long before, and they continued. Like, even into Robert Baratheon's reign, there's still the nastiness between actually the Tyrells and the Martells, because, there was a tourney and, oh no, Oberyn, hurt Willis, and now Willis is like partially crippled, and so there's that sort of hatred there. But they had kind of become friends, Willis and Oberyn, like, of their own accord beforehand. And it's almost like the Tyrells were just, like, looking for a reason to still be mad at the Martells. So I think that even if Aegon had conquered them, like, right away, there's still, and let's be real, there's still those little, maybe they weren't outright fighting, but man, there's a lot of petty business between these lords of Westeros. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Lannisters killed off an entire family at one point, okay?
Like, I forgot, was there a Vulture King after Targaryen marries Martell?
Few Vulture Kings, yeah. I believe,
after,
at different
after
times.
Yeah.
I agree with everything you just said. There's always been some petty squabbles in the North, Riverlands for sure. I mean, Blackwoods and Bracken's been going at it for forever, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I do think that you're right, that if they, if you conquer them earlier, there might be less, especially big things happening to keep the King's Peace, but I don't know if it would have squashed the beef entirely.
Well, and I think it's also the Targaryens, Aegon only had so many resources. Like, it's just him and his two sisters with their dragons, and he cannot be everywhere at once. Mm-hmm. He does not have that big enough of an army that is only loyal to him, houses that are sworn directly to the Targaryens. He can't really go do anything about it, because he just doesn't have the resources. Now, maybe several generations down the line, they would have developed the resources if they had, thought it was worth their time. But, you're always going to have these little border, like, whatever, just petty lords. Younger sons need to, like, blow off some steam or something. what's a little stabbing between neighbors? Yeah.
Okay. Yes, and the red over here?
In my opinion, I would say more Aegon and Senya, because Rhaenys died. One of their biggest failures is failing to keep their family united between Maegor and Aenys, where they basically, like, the way that those kids were raised, there was no way Aenys was so, like, obviously favored over Maegor. Maegor didn't even grow up in court. Magor was off on Dragonstone, like, wasn't praised by Aegon because he didn't want to outshine Aenys because Aenys is his heir, and he could have made Aenys' best warrior, and instead he made, I mean, his undoing, basically. Destroyed his own empire in, how old were those kids, like 16 years?
Mm-hmm. I mean, listen, I think that goes back to just, he had two wives. It was never gonna, mm-hmm. like, they might have, if they had had, like, a proper polyamorous relationship in place, it could have worked. I see it work with people all the time, and that's not how it was with them. And, yeah, but also, who here has children? Not many, really? Nobody's gonna raise their hand? I have stepkids. I have two stepkids. Okay, okay. I'm not gonna ask you to raise your hand for this next minute. You might treat your children equally, but don't tell me you don't have a favorite. I'm sorry, not sorry. Like, even I know my parents have myself and I have two sisters, and, like, listen, they treated all of us equally, but I know I'm my mom's favorite. Please. I'm the most responsible. But also, when it comes to, like, Maegor and Aenys, the problem there obviously being that there was a little bit of, maybe rancor is too hard of a word, but there were definitely some tough feelings between Visenya and Rhaenys. And then you've got their two sons, and Maegor is not a nice kid, like, from the start. So there's also that issue there, where it's like, first Aenys is favored, and then also Maegor not a good kid, not a good person.
I also think, too, just because Rhaenys was killed, and Aegon felt bad about that, so of course he treated Aenys a little differently, and, you know, probably what spoiled him a little more, because I think parents usually feel guilty about things like that.
Also, I think that there's a line in Fire and Blood, it might also have been in World of Ice and Fire, that Aegon wed Visenya out of duty, mm-hmm. and Rhaenys out of love. And I mean, you got a kid by each of them. Even if Aenys wasn't the better kid, isn't it more likely that...
I think Visenya also had a problem, though, with, was Aenys really Aegon's child?
Right. Uh-huh. But, I mean, Aegon is... I think that was over yeah. his head.
Yeah. Wait, if you look at the timeline of when everything happens, Maegor's not even born until after Rhaenys passes. I get the vibe that Visenya was a wife in name only, like she didn't actually have marital relations with her brother husband. Yeah, and so for whatever reason, Maegor didn't happen until after, and he's got like this constellation baby vibe. And I think that is part of like how he gets raised. He's like, okay, you're like, you're just like a consolation prize.
Well, you also have like kind of like this dark magic thing, you know, rumors around his conception as well, like... All of it points mm-hmm. to kind of evil.
But yeah, I mean, you're right. Really, the whole Targaryen dynasty was kind of screwed before it really even got... Well, maybe not before it got started, because he hadn't had... Maegor hadn't been born, at least, at the time of the conquest. Also, he was only, like, 27 when the conquest happened. Like, he'd be real ambitious at 27 years old. I wish I had that kind of ambition. Yes, right here.
Do you think if the Starks took, like, the Dornish approach of guerrilla warfare, they could have resisted the Targaryens? Because, I mean, the North's massive. Mm. It's full of trees. They can fly the dragons around constantly and not burn down every forest. And the dragons don't like the cold, in fact, from what I can tell from the books. Until Alysanne came 100 years later, not a single Targaryen stepped foot in the North, like, ever.
I think the geographic potential is there. That's just not how Starks do things.
Right.
The Starks are incredibly straightforward. Mm-hmm. Starks, they'll meet you on the field of honor. They're very practical. They're pragmatic. But they're not going to be like, okay, like, what kind of subterfuge can I get up to today? That's just not how they do things. The Martells, though, that is something that they do. That's more of a Dornish cultural trope, is like, okay, like, what sneaky thing can I do today?
Poison is a woman's or a Dornish person's weapon.
Yeah. And even the, you know, the northern women will just, they'll just stab you because, like, I don't have time for poison. Winter's coming, come on.
Exactly.
Okay, I think I totally agree with you, Jennifer, but I do think it would be interesting to see the Kranigmen doing something similar in the neck, mm-hmm. in the swamps and stuff. Mm-hmm. I definitely think there's an interesting potential to think about there, but.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they could definitely, I mean, the neck is a whole thing, cool. But dragons can just fly over the neck.
Yeah. I mean, there was the potential there. I just think that, this, like they said, Starks weren't like that. They went along with, you know, what was honorable.
Yeah, no, I agree. All right, we had a question over here. The back row first, and we'll get to you soon, I promise.
I think Martin is, like, really critical, both explicitly and implicitly, about Targaryen, like, propagandizing and myth-making. in terms of like blood purity stuff and also mm-hmm. like might is right kind of stuff. I just want to know if any of you had thoughts on like Targaryens consciously utilizing like persona and propaganda, both in the conquest and in like the running of the country.
Well, the Targaryens definitely have this kind of, they rule by exception, right? They get exceptions from the faith and all these other things. Your question makes me wonder though, how much of it is like conscious propaganda and how much of it they truly believe about themselves. I'm not sure. I think there's probably some of each depending on which Targaryen we're talking about, especially once the dragons are gone. That changes the game a lot. I definitely think they use it to their advantage. I just don't know how much of their own hype they believe. I think they probably believe a lot of it.
I think you're right when you say, like, it depends on the Targaryen we're talking about, though. Because I think that Daenerys had a lot of stuff put in her head by her brother Viserys that she maybe on her own wouldn't have, mm-hmm. you know. And even she has trouble believing it up until she literally hatches her dragons right. from
maybe
those
I eggs. Am a magical princess.
Yeah, I mean, some of them definitely knew. You know, Viserys even says, you know, we only have this power because we have these dragons, so.
Well, and I think the House of the Dragon show kind of touches on that because Jace's, however you say his name.
Jacerys, yeah.
Jacerys, the kid
who has a name like every other Targaryen name.
Yeah, that one guy. So the reason why that one guy is irritated in the show about having the dragon seeds, in the book it's his idea to do the dragon seeds. In the show he is like, I don't like this. But one of the reasons why he's like, about it is because it interferes with that Targaryen exceptionalism. Targaryens are exceptional because we're the only ones who can ride dragons. And if you take that away from us, what are we? We're just a bunch of people who marry their sisters. that specialness is like they're dragon lords. They are dragon lords. That's how they describe themselves. We ride dragons. We speak High Valyrian. We still hold mm-hmm. with Valyrian customs and traditions. We still like name ourselves and our children and our dragons after Valyrian gods and things like that. We are not the same as the rest of Westeros, and that's an intentional thing that they do. And when you start messing with that is when you start seeing like the Targaryen power shake a little bit.
Princess Bubblegum.
Yeah. I guess my question was related to, I know that, I forget which interview it was, but George did an interview where he kind of compared the dragons to like nuclear weapons, essentially, mm-hmm. the historical context and like where he draws inspiration from. So I don't know if y'all have like a favorite, like kind of, I guess, theme or trope in the book that you find you connect to like an actual historical event in, you know, history.
Well, I mean, it's so much of the, yeah, and just because this panel is supposed to stick to like Aegon's conquest, but yeah, throughout the whole of the story from Aegon's conquest to the current timeline, such mm-hmm. as it is, there's so many historical references, historical events, historical people that Martin used as, sometimes it's like, you know, okay, I see what you're doing here. And sometimes it's like, oh yeah, whoa, this is literally like the copy of this actual thing that happened. I don't think I've ever seen that article because I don't ever remember hearing or seeing anything about George comparing dragons to nuclear weapons, but oh my God.
I've seen the quote, but I don't think I've actually read the interview.
Well, I mean, either way, it's so correct because in Aegon's Conquest with Beleriand, he spews black fire that is so hot it melts stone. You know, Harren the Black is like, ha ha ha, my castle's made of stone. You can't burn me. Guess what? So, I don't know. What about you guys? Let's try to keep it to Aegon's conquest and historical references.
We do have a historical references in A Song of Ice and we have it tomorrow morning.
A very specific
at 10 a.m.
Oh yes, that's why I'm not on that panel.
Yes, because it's up against the parade. Sorry.
Well, I also have a hard no before 11 a.m. panels rule. I'm not a morning person. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so just keeping it to Aegon's conquest, if at all possible. Do you guys have a reference or a similarity that you found that you really enjoy?
Well, I think the thing that's the most obvious parallel is the Norman conquest of England. I think that's what really George was drawing on when he was doing this. You have kind of a foreign king who's got a claim, who comes in and he conquers everything and comes from a different culture and kind of imposes his own culture upon England. England up until that time was an Anglo-Saxon culture. And then the Normans come in, and you know that's the reason why cow is one word and beef is another word, because mm-hmm. you know, one's an Anglo-Saxon word, the other is a French word. But yeah, it's, I think that's where he was going for, was this is like Norman conquest.
Well, and too, there was a lot of petty squabbling before I mean, not that it didn't necessarily continue at all afterward, but I think that's
England
also
was a bunch of different petty kingdoms.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say is, you know, you had, like, look at England, you had all these little, you had Northumbria and whatever else, and, like, what was it, Alfred that came in and, and wanted to put them all together, so.
And the Vikings coming in and messing with everybody, too. Cough, Iron Islands. You were next, and then we'll get back there.
I just wanted to jump a little bit more into theorizing territory. Like, why do you think Aegon had two coronations, one at the Aegon Fort and then another one at Old Town?
I mean, I think the Old Town one definitely legitimized him more in the eyes of everyone in the kingdoms and in the eyes of the faith. Whereas when he's at the Aegon Fort, I mean, it's just it's a small fort and there's no city. I mean, I don't even know how many witnesses would have been there to witness it. I think one is just to proclaim that he is the rightful ruler, and the other one's more to cement himself as the rightful ruler after the fact.
And it's also part of that, I'm going to respect your cultures and tradition. So I'm not going to just declare myself king. I'm going to have your existing power structures say that I am the king, and that will make me a little bit more legitimate. Like, when you look at the calendar counts from the second coronation, not from the first one. Because that's, like, the real one as far as Westeros is concerned.
If someone had their hand... Yes.
I'm curious if you guys have any thoughts. There's, like, this... There's the main conflict of Aegon's conquest going on, obviously, troops and so forth, but there's also, it seems to me, like, there's this other proxy war going on in the background of all these different competing religions, Seven and the One and all this stuff, and that definitely manifests itself more with other religions popping up and so forth. So I'm curious if you guys have any thoughts on that.
Man, I have so many thoughts. Because it comes back down to that, those layers of culture. And, like, one of the things I have in my notes for a future panel is, like, colonial narratives in Game of Thrones. Because that's really what you're looking at. You're looking at various waves of colonization that have gone through Westeros. And you're just seeing kind of the aftermath of each one of those and the conflicts between them. So each of these is a colonial, up until, like, the Red God, the One God. That's not a colonial one. That's just an imported religion. But you see a lot of, like, really interesting things with those different cultures, and religion plays a large part into culture in most countries. The United States is very different in that respect. But yeah, like, I think there's a lot to say there.
Well, the faith of the Seven is the one followed by the most people at the time, and it has sort of a concrete power structure, whereas I don't think the followers of the Old Gods really care too much if the Targaryens convert to their religion or not. They're not out there trying to push their religion as much on other people. It's more tied into their culture, I think. Whereas the faith has, you know, a system, and they have septs, and they have a power structure that, you know, they can see if they accept the Targaryens, they could further their own religion that way.
I mean, the Targaryens, they don't really have a religion.
They are their own religion.
Right. But even, I mean, even then, or maybe the dragons are part, but I mean, yeah, they do not have an organized religion the way, like, even the Old Gods would be, you know, considered a somewhat, like, it's a pagan, you know, esque religion, but it is still organized in that there are many people who believe in it, and it's all kind of like they all have the same beliefs.
Yeah, there's
within
an orthodoxy
that system
to it.
Right. But yeah, I think that because the Targaryens don't have their own religion, they're kind of like, we'll throw ourselves in with this Seven nonsense. Like, sure. This sounds pretty. Look at all this iconography.
Well, and also, if we want to just touch a little bit on the historical aspects, the faith of the Seven is very much, it reflects the Catholic Church, the medieval Catholic Church. And so I think that's, Martin wanted a medieval Catholic Church in his setting, because he said before that he's taken historical events for A Song of Ice and Fire and then cranked them up to 11 to make his novels. So everything that he does comes from a historical source. And so he needed a medieval church, so he made a medieval church.
What year did we do the religion in high fantasy panel? Was that 2019? It's been a while.
It was pre-COVID, yeah.
I think it was 2019. There was a religion in high fantasy panel, so if you're interested in, like, more, especially because it looked into, like, Tolkien and other stuff too, come find me at the very end of this panel, and I'll give you a link to that, because I think you'd enjoy that. Okay, so we had a question over here. Yes, Orange Hat.
I have a question and a statement. Statement being that the Dornish and Targaryen fight was actually quite similar to that of the Russians against the Germans in World War II. And my question is, why did the Targaryens, like, go with the Northmen? Like, they have dragons and they practice dark magic. The Starks have, like, their own magic. They have fought against magic in the war before the conflict. Like, why did not go down there? Like, surely they've heard all these magical stories, especially with the war the Starks had just got out of.
You mean, like, why weren't they, I don't know, like, closer, like, just...
Or at least interested. If
yeah.
It's true, the statement of Aegon being going into the stage because of the prophecy. They have
yeah.
wards, they have magic, they have their own prophecy. Like, why did they not try to step in or at least investigate, like, what's going on down there? They had a giant wall, no one knows how it got there.
Well, to be honest, that's one of my biggest issues with the whole prophecy thing, is that you're right. If that prophecy was the reason, like, Aegon conquered the Seven Kingdoms and everything, and why was it then that they never went north until Jaehaerys and Alysanne took their dragons up there for a little... They just took them up there for a little visit.
Yeah,
you know, they're just hanging out with their friends. But also, I will say, like, the Starks are very insular. I mean, really, the north is very insular. And some of that comes from, yes, it's huge, and it's so far away from everything. And anybody that doesn't have a dragon to fly has to, like, go through the neck, which is a pain in the you-know-what.
It's a lot
so,
of
pain. Right. But again, also the Starks, even beyond that, the Starks are very insular. When, you know, not to like get totally off topic, but when Eddard was sent to be fostered by the Aerons, that was like a huge deal because that stuff did not happen. The Starks were like, yeah, no, we're better than you guys. We're just staying up here in our castle in the north.
Yeah, and Starks generally don't marry outside of the north. They tend
right.
to marry into their banner houses. Eddard is different because he spent time south and he brought home a southern wife, and that's kind of an unusual thing for Stark to do.
There's also, I can't remember what the theory is called, but there's a pretty, like, well-circulated theory about why Eddard was sent to be fostered by the Aerons, and, like, why he was, like, married to a Tully, et cetera. Or, well, why Brandon and then Eddard... Brandon was supposed to be, and then Eddard was married to a Tully, but that's neither here nor there. But, yes, no, I mean, you're...
But
you're,
now I want
to
know.
Right. Yeah, I'll have to... There is a... It's one of, like, the very, like, infamous fandom theories, and it is actually pretty legit. But for what you're saying, though, I think that you're right. Like, why weren't they kind of more interested in each other? And I get why the Starks weren't.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they just kind of want to be left alone. But it is very interesting that if the prophecy from
yes.
House of the Dragon was the reason that Aegon's conquest, like, the real, like, deep-seated reason that it happened, then why didn't Aegon ever go north to, you know, I don't know, like, check things out? Just a little bit of recon work, you know?
Yeah, I think he was trying to give them their independence because, like, they were the biggest one he had to worry about. So I think, you know, he conquered, Torin knelt. So he's like, okay, I'll leave y'all alone for a little while. Then all the mess with Maegor and Aenys happened, and Jaehaerys was pretty smart to be like, okay, I guess I should kind of go up there and, you know, check things out, or have Alysanne check things out and make sure everything's okay. So I think he was just trying to give them some of their independence or make it look like he was.
Okay, yes, Green Lantern, is that what you're...
That's what you're saying. I feel like the Targaryens didn't know the importance of protecting Westeros from the north when they did foresee that, because the wall was built, right? And they do have a protocol to send people to the wall to man the wall, so perhaps he did know the importance of what's going on to his prophecy, and that's one of the reasons why the wall was built.
Well, the wall had been there, but like prior to, as far as we know, the wall had been there way prior to the prophecy. But I mean, that said, you're right. Like, Aegon knew the wall was there. So he's like, and I think there's enough in the prophecy for him to understand that it's not necessarily, you know, it's not him or even necessarily one of his sons, but in the future, some Targaryen, but the wall is still there. So maybe it really is just like a, yeah, well, everything's still cool up there right now, and it's real cold up north. Like, my dragons don't like it. I think I'll just stick around King's Landing and, I don't know, raise some awful sons.
I don't remember the exact phrasing of the prophet, like Aegon's dream prophecy from the TV show. I don't remember if it says anything specifically about the North or just like, we've got to like unite the kingdoms to fight against a big threat. He may have assumed that the big threat would be like an invasion from Essos.
Right. I was going to say, just in
yeah.
the name
yeah,
of Song of Ice and Fire, it makes you wonder, right? They're like, oh, we'll handle this. But, you know, the ice portion's a big part of it. And it doesn't seem like anyone really gets that until Rhaegar.
Well, I mean, according
right.
to the show,
right,
Damon
exactly.
now, but yes, in the red over here.
I have one like little statement of like, nobody, don't marry dragon lords, don't marry into Starks. Nobody wants somebody warging into a dragon. But I also think.
or do we?
Going back to like the Dornish conversation, I think that like one of the biggest things that could have been different is, I can't think of her name, but she's like the Toad of Dorn.
Maria.
She had died sooner because her son was so game for like, just if not like bending the knee to being like, we don't need to fight. Maybe like they would have found like at the Daenerys solution of like, somebody of mine marries someone of yours, mm-hmm. and that's how we like join together. But like, because he's the one that sent the letter, if I remember.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was.
He sent his daughter with it as the mm-hmm. envoy.
Yep.
Like in his piece, but that didn't happen, and that happened immediately after his mother died. It's like to the amount of time that it took to get to. From Dorne to King's Landing, if I recall. Like, so I know there's the theory that Rhaenys was still alive and mm-hmm. being tortured, and it was, I will, like, do you want me to mercy kill her, is, like, the big theory that I know, but, like, and that's why he, like, left him be, but I still think that that's one of the biggest, like, what could have been.
I almost feel, this is, like, jumping ahead a little bit, but for a comparison, in The Red Dragon and the Gold, in this season of House of the Dragon, I know, obviously, it was a dragon fight and not a scorpion bolt, but I feel like Rhaenys and Meleys, how their mm-hmm. end happened, that's how I picture Rhaenys and Meraxes ending in Dorne. Like, she went down with her dragon. She was not still alive, hopefully. But yeah, no, so yes, you're right. Like, the son was the one, like, he immediately sent that envoy. I mean, listen, here I am, like... I mean, after all the marriage proposals Aegon had, why didn't this son of... He sends his daughter. I'm shocked there wasn't like a, here, marry my daughter. I don't know. The letter is just always going to be a point of contention with me because we're never going to know when it's sent. Yeah. But yes, I mean, you're correct. Like, they... I don't know. You guys have any thoughts? Because, like,
I think the letter is always going to be a mystery, and I think George intended it as such. Yeah. I think... I'm not saying he wrote himself into a problem... like on purpose or anything, but I think that was, he wanted a mystery ending to that, and that was the mystery ending, and I think that's one of those things I want to know, but I also don't know if I want to know either. In that sense, it's kind of fun to speculate about it.
Yeah, because like whatever we're thinking of right now is probably way cooler than what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
We might find out in a spinoff.
Yeah, you never know.
Yeah, in one of the 20,000 songs.
Right.
Yes, over there in the back corner.
Just going back to the Dornish and the Conquest, another reason, just from what I've been reading, that the Dornish might have had an advantage over the Targaryens is because they were descended from the Rhoynar, from Essos, who had been used to other Valyrian dragonborn before the Duke, enslaving them and taking over their land, and that was why the Valyrian for 10,000 ships left Essos, and then they landed in Dorne. So when she decided to burn the ships and said, you know, we're staying here, they already kind of had that knowledge of the Valyrians, of their dragons, and then using the geography of Dorne to their advantage, in because they, you know, don't have, you know, weapon really is there, other than the scorpion bolt against the dragon. So then when the conquest came, they were just like, not this again. Because of this, because of that, they were probably one of the few houses that actually exposed the weakness in the Targaryens, was that your dragons can't fix everything. And so we see that mirrored in the Stepstones with retreat to the caves, to get away from the dragon. So I also think that there's probably a reason why too. And then the fact that, you know, subsequently get to the Tyrells, who got jumped from Stewards to, you know, Lords Paramount of the region, all the stuff the Tyrells did to try to hold the land, and there's that beef between the two of them. So they already had experience dealing with them to the point where mirrors was going to be.
And the marriage between the Martells and the Targaryens didn't happen for so long. For those of you who might not have been able to hear, she's talking, and honestly, like, this isn't, like, something I ever really thought about, which is odd, I think, but, like, the idea of Nymeria and the 10,000 ships leaving where they were and, like, having knowledge of Valyria, Valyrians... Targaryens weren't really that important in Valyria, just FYI. Like, the Targaryens, like, Dany's dreamer, I had a dream, maybe we should leave, guys, like, something bad's gonna happen, but, like, they, they left. Not, it was 100 years, I think, before the doom happened. But like they left. So yeah, Nymeria and the 10,000 ships, they would have, having been from Essos, probably known kind of, obviously they didn't know about the doom necessarily or whatever, but they knew what was going on a little bit. Like, you can't have an entire area of the world where there are dragon lords and not know about it. So yeah, no, I mean, I love that idea. And I also love the fact that Dorne was like, God, not, F this, not again. Like, we ran from this one time, not and now we have to actually physically deal with it. Thank God we got mountains and deserts and caves and all. I'm trying so hard not to swear, Jen. I'm doing really good.
You're
this
doing
year.
Amazing.
Doing amazing. Just this year.
A beautiful job.
Any other questions? Yes, Orange Hat again.
I do have a question, but it's not like connected to Aegon's question. It's about the Stark.
Okay.
It's just seen as a very honorable house in everything they do. But everyone tends to forget about the lone or long night.
Oh. The Stark, the alleged either a Stark or a Bolton, leader of the Night's Watch who married the creepy
the
lady
King.
And became the Night King.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel you're not wrong, but I also feel like there's bad apples in every family, guys. Like, not every Stark can be totally 100% honorable. Not every Lannister is totally 100% bad. Not every Targaryen is, you know, crazy. Like, two sides of the coin here. I don't know. Like, but yeah, I mean, you're right. Like, yes, the Starks have done some bad things, or some Starks have done some bad things, but also allegedly it was maybe also a Bolton. And I prefer to think it's a Bolton, but there were some crappy Starks even outside of the Long Night thing. Let's be real.
Craig Stark's uncle that was like, no, I'll just pee in your region. Don't worry about it, kid.
Yeah. Well, if we don't have any additional questions, we'll start with you, and then I've talked enough. What's like your last question or factoid or thing that that this panel has kind of brought to the front of your mind about Aegon's conquest?
I mean, I definitely still want to know about the letter, which, like, you know, we will never know.
It's not
and
fair.
If we would ever get any of the other books, I'd like to see if George somehow ties in this Aegon dream into the books at all, or if he just leaves it separate.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. Wow. So, like, is he changing his mind now and going, okay, I'm going to add this in, or did they just do it for the show? That's really my only question. I don't know if I have any other insight.
I mean, that's fine. I mean, you're right. Like I said earlier, like, my guess is, and I think you'll probably agree, my guess is that the letter was a threat, that the Faceless Men were going to come kill his son, because he immediately goes and checks on Aemys on Dragonstone. But it might not have been, so.
Maybe the letter was like, hey, we know about the prophecy. Let's join up.
Well,
that's my really dumb theory.
I mean, well, it's not dumb though, because like, George could absolutely, retcon isn't really the right word, but
we're desert people, we're the fire, join up with us.
He could absolutely shoehorn that in to future text. So real quick, any other last thoughts?
I don't think so. I think we've hit on a lot of good stuff. You know, it's one of those things you always have in the back of your mind, some of these connections, but talking it out with all of you guys and hearing some of y'all's questions kind of solidifies that. And it's nice to kind of think about those connections through time.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice if one day we get to see Aegon's conquest play out on the silver screen. Yeah. We'll see.
The silver screen would be nice. Now, nothing against HBO, because I'm still loving House of the Dragon for the most part. But Jen, did you have anything else before I?
My last question is actually like, is this an adaptable? Like, could we turn this into an HBO series? And I think there's enough of a linear storyline of the conquest that you could do that. Just, you know. Who's going to play Aegon and his two sisters? Like, what's gonna
I just would rather have
Henry
it
Cavill.
Be a movie. Henry Cavill, there you go.
I mean, they already know what he looks like in a wonderful wig. So.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so guys, don't forget, we've got our Dragon Con charity donation jar over here. Also, please rate this panel. Give it 5 stars if you liked it. If you didn't like it, don't rate us
that. There is a spinoff in the works, allegedly, for Aegon's conquest.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, there's
allegedly.
Allegedly. Allegedly.
Thank you for listening to the Geek Saga podcast. If you like what you heard, please check out other Geek Saga entertainment endeavors, including the Sagas and Sass webcast and podcast, and Ice and Fire Con.